Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah with Lion of Lamb Ministries. Welcome to our teaching series that we're going through and teaching Paul's letters, but we have a different slant on just the normal teaching of his letters. We're pointing out how the Apostle Paul, who was a very observant Jew, was actually teaching Torah concepts to the Gentiles and trying to explain to the basis of the faith and why we believe what the Messiah has done is the work of redemption and how it works for us. Last episode, we were in Romans chapter 11, and I introduced to you right at the end where Paul talked about this whole thing of that we have these Jewish believers called the remnant of Israel, and then we have these Gentile believers that are coming in. They're the remnant of the nations, and they are being formed together to form what we call the whole grafted-in tree of Israel. That it is not Jewish believers who join the church, rather it's Gentile believers who join Israel, remnant Israel, together to be part of that. And there are many promises that God has given to Israel in the future, and those promises extend to Gentile believers. But most Gentile believers, Christians, have never heard these promises. They have no idea that this is what God is doing here at the end of the ages. And one of the things that I concluded with in the last episode is Paul's explanation about how all of this is going to come to a conclusion at a thing called the fullness of the Gentiles. And just to review that very quickly, the fullness of the Gentiles is about when Israel has been kicked out of the land of Israel, scattered into all the nations, into the lands of all the Gentiles. But there's a day coming when God is going to turn his face again toward the house of Jacob, restore the fortunes of Jacob, restore and bring back the scattered exiles of Israel. And according to the prophet Ezekiel, when, say, for example, the house of Judah returns, that's the Jewish people, they're going to bring companions with them. Those are Gentile believers that are associated with them. He's also going to bring back the house of Israel, those with the northern tribes. They're not called Jews, but they're called Israelites. And they're going to bring their companions with them, and that God's going to join together a Jew, Israelite, and Gentile believers. They're all going to be called the remnant of Israel, and he's going to be bringing them back to the kingdom. And he says that these events happen at the end of the age, and one of the things that marks the end of the age is called the fullness of the Gentiles. And so when Paul says for us in Romans 11, verse 26, and so all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, and he will remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. He's talking about the end of the age. He's talking about the return of the Messiah. He's talking about when the Messiah comes to establish his kingdom here on the earth. Now, I mentioned to you that this event has also been spoken of by the prophets about all the scattered exiles and how they return. I want to take you to two passages of Scripture that Jeremiah gives to us that defines this greater exodus that we're talking about. The ancient exodus out of Egypt, we've all heard about that. Moses was dispatched from the burning bush to go back to get the children of Israel. They overcame Pharaoh. Certain judgments befell upon Egypt. We had the Passover. The blood of the Lamb covered them. We're out of there. We leave. We cross the Red Sea. We make our way over to Mount Sinai. We get the Torah, and God establishes the nation of Israel, makes a covenant with them, and so forth. A great story of redemption, a great story of salvation and deliverance. Well, that's the basic story of the gospel. That wasn't just intended for Israel. That was a micro picture of what God was going to be doing all over the world. The gospel, the good news, is to the whole world for salvation and deliverance for all men. And he's going to use Israel as a light to the nations, explaining it, illuminating, and so that all the nations of the world would understand how this works. In effect, the whole story of the Exodus is really a prophecy about what's supposed to happen at the end of the ages when we have the world. And Paul's going to make reference to this repeatedly and draw us back to it. So let me take you to Jeremiah. And the first passage I'm going to show you is in Jeremiah 16, where this thing is being described by Jeremiah. By the way, Jeremiah I would remind you in chapter 31, he was the guy who prophesied the new covenant. Before he prophesied the new covenant, he talked about these promises that were going to be part of that future new covenant. Here's what he said in Jeremiah chapter 16. Verse 14, therefore, behold, days are coming, declares, as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel out of Egypt, but as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel from the land of the north and from all the countries where he had banished them, for I will restore them to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. Now, Jeremiah had already seen the house of Israel go into Assyrian captivity. He's the one who prophesied that the house of Judah was going to go into Babylonian captivity for a while. He knew that God had a plan to bring all of Israel back eventually. And, oh, by the way, just historically, that house of Judah went to Babylon, they came back, and then they got crossways with the Romans, and the next thing you know, the house of Judah was scattered into the nations, just like the house of Israel. But the prophets talk about how two houses will come back. Two houses of Israel will come back. I would remind you in chapter 31, where he talks about the promise of the new covenant, he says, this is given to the house of Judah and the house of Israel. It's given to all of Israel for it. I would also remind you, my friends, that he did not say the new covenant was given to the Gentile nations. It was given to Israel. Again, let me repeat this for you. According to the prophecies of the new covenant, Jewish believers, either from the house of Judah or Israelite believers from the house of Israel, don't go join the church, which is set up separate from Israel. Gentile believers are to join with the house of Judah and the house of Israel into the commonwealth of Israel. The tree that we are grafted into is called Israel. That's the olive tree. There's two types of branches. There's natural branches and there's wild branches. The natural branches are some of those of the biological descendants of Jacob. The wild branches are the people of the other nations. They're both grafted in. They're both received. We belong in the same tree together. That tree is not called the church. That tree is called Israel. The church has not replaced Israel. The church is a substitution for God's promises of Israel. Wow, that is such a fundamental issue that it's stunning that we have believers walking around believing in the Messiah and yet don't understand the overarching plan of God. And that's what Paul is teaching about. That's what the prophets have taught about. And this is what Jeremiah is prophesying. There's a day coming when we're going to have another exodus. And when we use that word, we'll not be referring to ancient Egypt again. We'll be talking about what God does at the end of the age for it. Let me read the second passage to you. It's very similar to this one. It's in Jeremiah 23. And in that one, he adds one other additional thing. As Christians, we should pay close attention to what this says. Beginning at verse 3 of Jeremiah 23, it says, then I myself shall gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I have driven them, and shall bring them back to their pasture, and they will be fruitful and multiply. We're talking about God gathering up all of his people from all of the different nations. By the way, we're not talking about the rapture here. We're talking about God fulfilling something here on the earth that he's promised to Israel. Verse 4, I shall also raise up a shepherd over them, and they will tend them, and they will not be afraid any longer, nor will they be terrified, for none will be missing, declares the Lord. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. That is the Messiah. The Messiah is the righteous branch of David. He's the son of David. He's going to be raised up after David, and he will reign as king and act wisely. And as you know, Yeshua is the King of Kings. He's the King of Israel. and do justice and righteousness in the land. Doing justice and righteousness is what the law teaches. He will be doing what the law teaches, not something separate from it. And in his days, Judah will be saved, and Israel will dwell securely. Both Judah and Israel are included. And in his name, by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. That's definitely a description of the Messiah, and that's what he intends to do in the future. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when they will no longer say, as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. We're not going to be talking about Egypt when the Exodus. We're not talking about the one from Egypt. We're going to be talking about a different Exodus. Verse 8, but as the Lord lives, who brought up and led back the descendants of the household of Israel from the north land and from all the countries where I had driven them, then they will live on their own land. This is the greater Exodus. This is what happens at the end of the ages. As a Jewish believer, let me give some explanation to you. If you walk up to one of my Jewish believers and you say, well, why is it that you don't believe that Yeshua of Nazareth is the Messiah? If he has any modicum of training in the law and the prophets, here's what he's going to say to you. He said, because Yeshua didn't fulfill the prophecies. And you're going to go, he didn't fulfill the prophecies? What are you talking about? He fulfilled all kinds of prophecies. And he's going to take you to this prophecy. And he's going to say, all the scattered exiles of Israel have not come back. That prophecy says the Messiah is going to bring back all the scattered exiles of Israel. Yeshua of Nazareth did not bring anybody back. So how can he be the Messiah? The Messiah is supposed to do that. And you're going to sit there in a quandary and not know how to answer him. It is true the Messiah is going to bring him back, but it's what happens at the end of the ages. That's not the work of redemption. That's the work of restoration. You see, a lot of people don't understand. There are three great works of God: creation, redemption, and restoration. That's what the Bible teaches. But you know, the Jewish people, they think there's just creation and restoration. My Christian brethren, they just think there's creation and redemption. And as a result of not understanding what the whole scripture teaches or what the prophets teach, they don't get it. Yes, we've seen God's creation. Yes, we've seen his redemption, but we haven't seen the restoration yet. The Messiah is supposed to do that. It's in the future. The other answer that I gave to some of my Jewish brethren was, well, that exile come back, and the exile is supposed to be from all of the nations. I said, at the time that Yeshua showed up, the house of Judah was still in the land. They hadn't been kicked to all nations. So as a result, this prophecy can't be fulfilled until Judah is kicked into all the nations. And they didn't get kicked to all the nations until after 70 AD. So we got to be talking about a prophecy that happens after that. That's the reason why we're so interested in it today, is because we've seen the house of Judah return back to the land. By the way, the prophecy said, I will save the tents of Judah first. Now we're waiting for the rest to come back. We're waiting for all of us to be gathered up to be taken to his kingdom. And as I mentioned to you before, if you want to know specifically the details of it, it's in Ezekiel chapter 39. Ezekiel chapter 39 is talking about the aftermath of a particular end time war involving Israel and their surrounded enemies. And about how there's this great war, and the enemies from the north invade, and God steps in, delivers the children of Israel. As Joel the prophet says, the name of Israel will be put to shame no more, ever again. God pours out his spirit on all mankind. He's demonstrated that he's the God of Israel. The nations know that surely there's a God in the midst of Israel. Those are the end time events. And then he says, now I'm declaring the end of the exile, and it's time to bring my people home. And that's part of the scenario of his second coming. It's a much grander picture than what most Christians have been told. You've just been told, oh, we just suddenly show up and blink, he's in the clouds, we get zapped up, that's it. There's a whole Bible full of prophets telling you all about what's going to be going on. And yet we ignore all of that word and we go for this simple definition of the return of the Lord. I guarantee you there's much more going on than what you've been told. The scriptures say so. And Paul is talking about the fullness of the end of the Gentiles. He's talking about these events that come where thus all Israel shall be saved, as we talked about. Now, Paul is going to step back for a moment and say, well, if this is the great plan of God, and God's going to deliver Israel in the end, bring them back from exile from the nations, and they're going to be joined by a lot of believing Gentiles along with them, what is the status of affairs at the moment? Well, in Romans 11, verse 28, here's what he says. From the standpoint of the gospel, they, the Israelites who don't believe, are the enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants these blessings. So that's God's point of view toward Israel. For the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. I want you to step back for a moment. Any person who says that God is done with Israel and is now working with the church, he is saying that God is a liar. Because God said his call upon Israel is irrevocable and it is forever. In fact, I'll tell you how he says it. In fact, it's demonstrated for us when he established the covenant with Abraham from the very beginning. If you remember, with Abraham, he told Abraham to prepare certain sacrifices. He was going to make a covenant with him and his descendants. And there were five different sacrifices. And what Abraham did was he prepared them and he flayed them open. And according to the ancient tradition, when you made a covenant of this might, you made a cutting, as it was, the two parties that are going to make an agreement, they walk between these flayed open sacrifices with the understanding that if I don't keep this covenant, then may I be flayed open just like these sacrifices. In other words, you put yourself under a penalty of death if you don't keep the agreement. Let's do it. Now, according to the account, Abraham prepared the sacrifices. God then came to Abraham in a whirling, fiery tornado. He had put Abraham in a kind of a deep state of trance where he could see what was going on, but he was separate from it so he wouldn't be harmed by the presence of God. So God walked down through those sacrifices and he pronounced the covenant between him and Abraham and his descendants. Did you know the scripture does not record that Abraham ever walked down through there? So what kind of covenant was this that God made with Abraham and his descendants? Well, it's a covenant in which God keeps both parts. God says, if I don't do what I say, may I be flayed open like these sacrifices. And oh, by the way, Abraham, since you're not walking down through, I'm walking down through for you too. And if you don't keep the covenant, may I be flayed open like these sacrifices. Now, do you understand why the Messiah had to be crucified? He's paying the price for Abraham and his descendants not keeping the covenant with God. God pays the price for us. That's what redemption is. That's what propitiation is. That's the payment. That's what sacrifice is about. And God has done that. Now, the conclusion of it is that this is a rock solid covenant. In fact, as Paul says here, verse 29, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. He goes on to say, for just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now have been disobedient because of the mercy shown to you, they also now should be shown mercy. For God has shut up all in disobedience so that he may show mercy to all. God's mercy that has been shown to the Gentiles is certainly appropriate to be shown to those of Israel as well. Now, Paul is kind of almost, if you will, in kind of a daze of how spectacular this thing works that God has done. If you stop and think about it for a moment, we didn't do anything. We've received pure grace and mercy from God. Are just simply believing God and trusting the promise He made for it. That's what's counted for righteousness. That leads to salvation. It's not about being religious. It's not about doing things. It's about the incredible things that God has done. Here's how Paul concludes it. Verse 33, oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable are his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has become his counselor, or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Paul's trying to explain how incredible what God has done for us in this whole process. Now he's going to shift gears here for a moment, and he's going to go into chapter 12, and he's going to kind of say something kind of interesting to us. Chapter 12, verse 1 says, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. God has done all of these incredible things. So what is it that we should do? He said, I'm urging you by the mercies of God to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. You know what he's actually saying? You should go up to the altar of God and put yourself up on the altar of God. You should give all of yourself to the Lord. And what's really fascinating is that he's using the language of the altar and what is taught back in the law. In fact, he goes on to say this, verse 2, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. In other words, I want you to come to understand something. I want your mind to be completely changed and transformed. I want you to understand what God's really doing and what your part of God's plan is. And he uses the word picture of, I want you to put yourself up on the altar. Well, you don't know this, but I'm going to go ahead and share with you very quickly. He is teaching a very important teaching out of the law about sacrifices. In fact, in Leviticus chapter 6 and beginning at verse 9, it says this, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning, and the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. A whole burnt offering is totally and completely a gift to God. None of it is taken off the altar. None of it is eaten like other sacrifices are done. Most sacrifices go up, they get burned and cooked, they're pulled off, and they make a feast to the Lord. Not a whole burnt offering. A whole burnt offering is given totally and completely to the Lord. None of it is taken off. It's completely consumed on the altar. And he's making a comparison of that you should become like a whole burnt offering to the Lord. That this is the proper way for you to learn. And by the way, as a result of you becoming a whole burnt offering, you give totally, completely all of you to the Lord. It's going to change your mind, your thinking, and you're going to see and understand things you didn't understand before. Now, what is so fascinating is this is another one of those places where the scribes did something interesting in the Torah scroll that you probably have never heard of. This is where one of the jots and tittles are at. You remember Yeshua said, not a jot or tittle shall pass away until all is accomplished. Those are scribal marks. They're special teachings. So when you go to Leviticus chapter 6, verse 9, let me read the verse again to you. This is the law for the burnt offering. the burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night. The word for hearth, in other words, the fire up on the top of the altar, the fire, the pyre that's going on there, the hearth. In the Hebrew, that Hebrew word has something very interesting done in an actual Sefer Torah scroll. In the Hebrew, the scribes write that word, and they take the letter mem, and they make it small in that word. Matter of fact, you're reading the word, and all of a sudden, whoa, the letter mem is made very small. The letter mem makes the phonetic sound m, m sound. And the letter mem, there's a meaning to that particular letter. It means chaotic waters. Now, what in the world is going on? What does that have to do with what we're talking about? Well, the chaotic waters that the letter mem means, it means the waters that are chaos that come forth when a woman is pregnant and she suddenly breaks water and is about to give birth. That's the chaotic waters we're talking about, because if you've ever been around a woman who's in the final stages of her pregnancy and suddenly her water breaks and all of a sudden there's like chaos in the house. Oh my gosh, there's a baby coming. We got to get her to the hospital. We're getting ready to have a baby. And there's great excitement and anticipation. So that moment, that sense of it, that's what the letter mem means. The actual shape of the mem, it has both a open mem and a closed mem. There's two ways the mem can be done. A mem sofit, which means a mem at the end of the word, is closed off. A mem in the middle of the word is an open mem. And the letter in that, we're talking about the womb of the woman. The waters come forth from the womb. And in the womb of a woman, this is how a new living soul comes into the world. When a woman conceives, there's a new person that's coming into the world. There's a living soul in her womb. When those chaotic waters come, that living soul comes forth and takes their place in the world with the rest of us. It's a very powerful word picture and concept for it. So guess what the scribes do with that letter? They say that when you put the whole burnt offering up, you came in, you put a whole burnt offering up. The proper way to present your whole burnt offering to the Lord is that you're supposed to not only put the lamb or the goat up there, but you're supposed to put your soul up there with it. That's the teaching of how you present a whole burnt offering. You put your soul on the altar. Well, guess what Paul's teaching here in Romans 12? Now that we understand all that God has been doing, how he's establishing the nation of Israel to bring forth the gospel and the Messiah, how he's gathering up and bringing all the peoples of the world, they're learning about the Messiah, being redeemed and brought in. And now that we understand all of those concepts, guess what he says to us? Well, right now that you understand that, you need to present yourself as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Put your soul into this. Now, we already know that the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, and all of your soul. But the word picture is given to you is just like you're presenting a whole burnt offering, put you up there on the altar. Give all of yourself to the Lord now that you understand what God has done for you. Let me move to Romans chapter 13. And again, he's going to reiterate something I've already shared with you that Paul had already taught, but he's going to review it with you again. Romans 13, verse 8, he said, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." It's not the end of the law. You're fulfilling the law. You're filling it up full of meaning. And then he goes on in verse 9, and he's going to repeat some commandments. Verse 9 says, "For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, love your neighbor as yourself is the second greatest commandment. It comes out of the book of Leviticus. He's repeated some of the commandments that come in the Ten Commandments. So let's review some basic teaching of the law that Paul is reminding you of. There are Ten Commandments that God gave. Now, the way the commandments work is there is a standard, there is an objective. The commandment is a certain objective. There's a standard that has to be done to, and then there's a circumstances or the considerations that are done in the setting of that keeping the commandment. And not every commandment is appropriate for every person. For example, there are certain commandments that are given to men that women don't have to worry about. There are certain commandments that women are given that men don't have to, they don't apply to a man. There's certain commandments given to the priest. If you're not a priest, you don't have to worry about that commandment. There's certain commandments given at certain times of the day or times of the year. If it's not that time of the year, those aren't the circumstances, then the commandment doesn't apply. And what it all boils down to is for everybody, of all the commandments, it basically comes down to for everybody that exists in the world, priest, man, woman, child, whatever, there are 10 basic commandments. That's what God spoke from Mount Sinai. The 10 basic commandments that applies to every person. They came in two tablets. The first 5 commandments can be grouped together. These are commandments that has to do with your relationship with God. The second 5 have to do with all the commandments have to do with dealing with other people. And basically, what Paul taught was, herein do I exercise myself continually to have a conscience void of offense toward God and toward man. That's what he said in the book of Acts when he gave testimony of himself. That's his teaching. You see, I've taken the commandments of God, and I try to not offend God. I take the commandments of man, and I don't try to offend man. But let me tell you something rather interesting about these commandments, and let me pose this as a question to you. What is the first commandment of the Ten Commandments? Now, if you ask the average Christian, he's going to say, let's see, I've looked at the plaque that Christian Bookstore sells me, and it says, you shall not have any other gods before me. And this is a classic case where you just are not listening. If you go back and listen to what God said, he said this first. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's the first commandment. Whoa. Wait a minute, it was kind of written in the indicative mood. What's the imperative? I don't understand what the commandment is there. Yeah, because you're not really hearing the Lord. The Lord said, I'm the one who's the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. Basically, he's saying, would you listen to me? Will you believe me? Believe me. Don't believe some other God. Believe the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Believe me. By the way, if you're going to sin against God, set up idols, fail to keep the Sabbath, dishonor your father, your mother, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to violate that first commandment before you violate the other commandments. You're going to violate that first one because you're not going to believe in that God. And then you're going to go ahead and decide to sin against God. The same thing is true about the second set of commandments that have to do with men. If you'll remember, the commandments were don't murder, don't steal, don't lie, don't commit adultery. And then the last one was you shall not covet any of your neighbor's stuff. You see, there's an understanding that before you sin against another man, you will always break the 10th commandment first. You will covet something. Whereas God, you didn't believe in him. Now you will want something in your heart, in your mind, and that's what will then lead you to commit murder, commit adultery, steal, and lie. There's something you want, something. Sin begins with the heart. That's what the law teaches. Paul is now giving you a summary level of the commandments having to do with other people. Verse 9, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so he says here, hey, love does no wrong to the neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment or the keeping of the law. That's right. Loving, if you love, you will never violate the commandments of the law. And what is love? It's something that comes from your heart. If you will obey God from the heart, you will not be transgressing God. If you will love your neighbor, if you really will love your neighbor, you won't steal from him. You won't lie to him. You won't commit adultery with his wife. You won't murder him. And it turns out that if you can just learn how to do that thing with the heart, you can love God, love your neighbor. If you can just do that, you will have fulfilled all of the law. You will have obeyed all the law, and the penalties of the law have no bearing on you whatsoever because you're obeying the law. I live here in Oklahoma, and I consider myself to be a law-abiding citizen. I do my ever best to obey the traffic laws. I certainly don't go out and steal from my neighbor. I don't steal from the bank. I don't lie on official forms. I don't lie to other people. And in effect, I keep the commandments of the Lord. And as a result, I don't have any penalties, and no police pulls me over to hand me a ticket because I didn't violate the law. So I've basically kept the law. I fulfilled the law. And as a result, I don't have a problem. So guess what Paul's teaching you to do? Keep the law. If you love your neighbor, you will be keeping the law. Now, he's not telling you to keep the law for salvation. We've already talked about that. We know where salvation comes from. But he's telling you to keep the law. I want to remind you of something that Yeshua taught. If any man, this is Yeshua, if any man teaches another person so as to annul the least of these commandments, then he will be least in the kingdom. I know a lot of teachers, Christian teachers, who tell you that since you believe in Yeshua, that you should not keep the commandments, shouldn't keep any of them. And yet at the same time, they will expect you to not murder and not steal and so forth. But that's the law. And they want to somehow categorize the law. They want to just take a piece of the law. I call it a cut-and-paste Bible. Okay, let's see. Let's not murder. Let's cut that one out of the law. Let's put it in our Bible. Yeah, we want that one. Okay, don't steal. Oh, yeah, I like that commandment. Let's put that one over here. Oh, that unclean stuff. Don't eat this. Oh, no, I don't like that commandment. Leave that to the Jews. I don't want that in our Bible. So they have what we call a cut-and-paste Bible. They say that wine and alcohol, those are sin. God says they're clean foods. They're supposed to be taken in moderation, but they're clean foods. God says that pork, shellfish, and all that, that's unclean. Don't eat that. And they say, no, I like pork and shellfish. I want that in my list of kosher. Does that sound like you're obeying the Lord? It definitely is not. That is not obeying the Lord. We know you're supposed to obey the Lord. Even if you're a believer in Yeshua, you're supposed to obey the Lord. And what did Paul teach? You need to fulfill the law. You need to keep all of the commandments of the Lord. When I live here in Oklahoma, I keep all of the laws. I don't pick and choose which law I'm going to do. Oh, that stop sign law, forget it. By the way, I'm going to blow through the stop sign. If I don't see any cars coming and I don't see any cops around, I'm just going to blow through the stop sign. I'm going to drive like that. That's not keeping the law. That's not fulfilling the law. That's me breaking the law and violating the law. And the day's coming when I will be caught. By the way, you know, they come up with that new system that's kind of like God looking over your shoulder. They got those cameras in those intersections, and they take a picture of you and your license plate when you blow through the stop sign. God sees everything we do. He sees when you obey Him and when you don't obey Him. We should not go around fooling ourselves and deceiving ourselves into thinking that we know how to walk out the faith and ignore His commandments. Paul is not ignoring the law. He's not ignoring that. He is teaching it to the Gentile believers of the faith and explaining that they're part of Israel. And we know for a fact that Israel was commissioned to do it. Well, I will be happy to remind you that in every major commandment in the Torah, Moses says, this is a commandment for the native born and for the alien and sojourner who may be among you. That's what every major commandment says. It is not exclusive to the Jewish people or just to the people of Israel. Those commandments were given to every person, no matter where they come from, who believe in the God of Israel. You see, it's from the heart that you learn to obey. It's from the heart you learn to sin. Folks, that's Paul's teaching in the book of Romans. In our next episode, I'm going to be moving through some of the other letters. In fact, in the next episode, I'm going to take you into 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians and some of the other letters that Paul did, pointing out again what I've been sharing with you in Romans, that Paul is teaching the law to the Gentiles. That's our teaching for this week. Shalom to all of you.